Thank you. Be seated. Court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner in Rome Plumont v. Secunda Steel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Now, may it please the court, Ms. Marie Yates will present argument from petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, the issue in this occupational disease case, in light of this court's decision in Childs, is whether...
Just by your statement that we're not having a contest about whether this is an occupational disease or not.
No, sir, we're not. This is an occupational disease. Sir. Could you speak loud? Yes, ma'am.
Is it a late occupational disease case?
Yes, ma'am. I would agree that it's a latent occupational disease case. And the issue is whether in this latent occupational disease case, whether both the fact of injury and the causal link to the work must be objectively verifiable and inherently undiscoverable before the discovery rule can apply. This court held in Childs, in a latent occupational disease case that was silicosis, that the discovery rule did apply, and that under the discovery rule, the cause of action accrued when the plaintiff knew or should have known both the fact of injury and the causal link to the work. That was implicit in the majority opinion in Childs that the discovery rule applied under the two-part test in Alta. In fact, that's what Justice Hankinson wrote.
Well, let me back up. I think the question was brain tumors can occur for reasons other than occupational injury.
That's correct. But the plaintiff has alleged this in terms of an occupational disease case. In other words, his allegation is that this brain tumor was caused because of his work exposure. So in that sense, it's an occupational disease case. And our argument is that in an occupational disease case like this one, where the plaintiff's allegation is that Mr. Steele, 28-year-old Mr. Steele, contracted this rare form of brain cancer because of his exposure at work for several years at Rome Palanque to low levels of naturally occurring radiation, that in that type of occupational disease case, unlike silicosis, where there's scientific consensus and there isn't any doubt that the causal link to the work is objectively verifiable, that this case is different and that you can't jump over the objectively verifiable prong of the discovery rule applicability test in Altai and SV, and that if you apply the objectively verifiable prong to this case, you would determine that this is not an objectively cause of action
in a summary judgment context. Mm-hmm. What is the level of proof that the plaintiff must bring to dispute an issue on objectively verifiable?
Okay, Judge Enoch, our case is unusual in this summary judgment in the sense that, in this case, the plaintiff agreed to accept the burden of proof.
Well, but he already had it.
Well, for purposes of summary judgment.
No. He already had it all the way through, didn't he?
Right, but for purposes of summary judgment.
But aren't there just legions of cases that say, even though the plaintiff has the burden of proof, under Section C of 156A, the movement has the burden to show as a matter of law. So how can you say that it was Mr. Steele's burden to prove his case before it got to the merits?
Because unlike the usual case, Your Honor, in this case, Mr. Steele's counsel agreed to two agreed case
I know what he agreed to, but how does that change the burden of proof which he already had?
Well, how it changed the burden of proof is that the trial judge ordered and he agreed to come forward by X date before summary judgment mm-hmm. with legally yeah. sufficient evidence of causation. And that's our contention that
which
that does.
Did.
Well, that's what the Court of Appeals said, and that's why we're here.
No,
I think that's wrong.
From a factual standpoint, they did file the affidavit that the pretrial order said
that's
you must
correct.
Find.
He filed the
but
affidavit.
Your quarrel is, so what? It doesn't state what it's supposed to
that's
state.
That's right. That's our quarrel, Your Honor. And our,
but
and
our, so, isn't it still your burden to prove as a matter of law with whatever they had there was not causation?
He has the burden of proof under the case management order to come forward with legally sufficient evidence of causation, and it's not.
No, it said come forth with an affidavit from a medical doctor that says within a reasonable medical probability the brain tumor was caused by his work.
That's right, Your Honor, and when we've reproduced
it. That's what he
it,
said.
That's right, and in the Court of Appeals, the plaintiff conceded that shifted the burden of proof on causation to him.
So he's conceded that.
He's conceded. It's tab in our poster book, but Your Honor, it's tab 7. Plaintiffs have admitted. Plaintiffs told the Court of Appeals, this is from the Court of Appeals brief, the trial court improperly placed the burden regarding causation on the non-movement Steele. But his problem with that complaint is they'd agreed to the case management orders placing burden on him.
Well, there were other remedies for failure to comply with the case management order, are there not?
Sure.
Is that, why do you say it has to be that it's remedied in effect through summary judgment, switching the burden of summary judgment? What rule of procedure allows a trial court to do that in the context of summary judgment, to switch the burden for failure to comply with a pretrial case management order?
Okay, as we cited in our reply brief, there are a number of instances where the other party that doesn't normally have the burden of proof on something takes the burden. And if the plaintiff, or in this case it happens to be the plaintiff that accepted the burden, if the plaintiff accepts that burden without objection, then the burden should shift.
They accepted it for discovery purposes. Where do the rules allow the trial court to change the rules of summary judgment as they then existed and take the burden off of you in summary judgment to come forward affirmatively and disprove each other?
I can't point you to a specific rule of procedure that says that he can accept the burden. I can point you to cases such as State versus Payne. Remember in the charge context where the other side took the burden and the court said, well, he took the burden, and so that's no problem. And we cite another case in our footnote in our reply brief where the court says we're not going to correct it if you took the burden.
Do you lose this case if the court decides that the plaintiff did not take the burden on the motion for summary judgment?
If you conclude that he did not accept the burden on causation, then I probably lose on the Jeffrey Steele claims. I still should not lose. Well, no, I guess I would also lose on the Gregory Steele, because if you don't believe that he took the burden, then I can't make my legally insufficient evidence argument, and because I would have then had the burden to negate causation, as opposed to him having the burden to come forward.
Don't you have an expert facts on the record negating causation?
Well, we did put in an affidavit from a toxicologist, Dr. Stanley Peer, who attacked Dr. Thielbaum's affidavit.
On the point that you cannot conclude that this cancer was the result of rare earth minerals causing.
Right, but I'm not standing here saying that I would take the position that Peer's affidavit conclusively proves as a matter of law no causation. That's the posture that we're here on. Okay, that the plaintiff accepted the burden of proof on causation by a specific date, two times in two case management orders, and said, I will come forward with proof on causation. And the evidence that he came forward with was the affidavit of Dr. Stanley Tiedelbaum. And as a matter of law, that evidence is legally insufficient evidence of causation under this court's decisions in Havner and Gamble and Roberts. And the way we get from there to the negation of the objective verifiability standard is this analysis that we put forward on our chart, and there's a small version of that in tab 4.
Ms. Yates, before you get to that, let me ask you a question concerning how we apply this particular test. Mm-hmm. And I want to use by analogy two different ways of analyzing a constitutional challenge. There's a facial challenge and an as-applied challenge. Mm-hmm. And it seems as though what you are arguing in this case is to apply the discovery rule standards concerning objective verifiability on an as-applied basis as opposed to a facial challenge basis. And it seems to me that the ways that we've handled the inherently undiscoverable aspect is facial. In other words, under any circumstances, not necessarily the circumstances limited to this case, but under any circumstances, is this going to be inherently indiscoverable? If that's the case, why should we not also apply the same, let's say, facial challenge as opposed to an applied challenge on the objectively verifiable analysis, such that we don't look necessarily at the facts of this particular case, but we look as to whether or not a brain tumor or whatever the injury may be could be objectively verifiable?
Well, I don't know that I quarrel with that analysis, Your Honor, but I think our argument would still work. In other words, if it was the plaintiff's burden of proof to come forward and prove legally sufficient evidence of causation, part of what he's got to prove is general causation. I'm referring now to Justice Hankinson's decision in Hammer. It's general causation versus specific causation. Okay? And part of that is, can exposure to radiation ever cause this rare form of brain cancer or cancer? And we would say Tiedelbaum's affidavit is legally insufficient evidence on general causation. So if you want to analyze it as a facial attack or an as-applied attack, I don't think that would matter to our analysis.
But if you say radiation didn't cause it, then it's not an occupational disease case.
That's right, Your Honor, but I'm taking...
So when you say earlier that it is an occupational disease case, you're just saying that's what it's been pleaded.
That's what I mean, yes, Your Honor.
But in Child, the difference in Child's was... you couldn't get silicosis any other way than it worked.
That's right, and the Court of Appeals recognizes that. You know, they say silicosis and asbestosis is one thing because that's always related to the work, but this cancer is something else, and it may not be related to the work. That's why I think the application of the objective being verifiable from is so important. And if you want to talk about categories of latent occupational diseases, you know, it's one thing to say that silicosis or asbestosis is inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable, but that doesn't mean that every allegation of a latent occupational disease would meet that test.
And but when you start off saying this is a latent occupational disease case, you don't mean to concede
that they prove causation. What I'm trying to say is that's the posture that it comes in, that's their allegation. I mean,
And you're distinguishing, Charles, this being a case where the discovery rule would not apply then.
That's right. That's what we're saying. The discovery rule does not apply.
And Childs begins with well-established case law showing that in that type of case, the discovery rule does apply, and then begins to talk about how the discovery rule works.
That's right, Your Honor. You said that that you agreed that the Altai standard, under the Altai standard, two-part test, the discovery rule did apply, and there's a lengthy discussion of whether the causal link to the work in that case was inherently undiscoverable.
And then you're also in this case asking us to frankly not decide this case in the usual posture of a summary judgment motion, as the rule read at the time this one was granted, but in fact looking at it via the scheduling order, in fact we have this unique procedural animal here,
right,
basically,
right,
that puts the plaintiff as a result of the trial court order to the burden of proving causation.
That's
before,
right,
the case went forward.
Just like it would be under the new summary judgment rule at that point. You know, Judge Owen asked what procedural device allows it under the new summary judgment rule, but this is precisely what would happen.
No, I know, but see, that wasn't in effect. Let me make sure I understand your argument. Are you saying that even if we disagree with you, that the plaintiff did not assume the burden, that you lose on limitations with regard to Jeffrey Steele?
Well, my difficulty there is that it's in terms of whether or not it's objectively verifiable. Then if I cannot rely on his burden of proof on the sufficiency of the evidence on causation, then I have to have come forward and negated objective verifiability. Okay? Then, and I feel like unless I can place the burden on him, that's a difficult thing for me to do on this record.
All right, going back to where you were wanting to go, it's your position with regard to objective verifiability that we must be up to the red box as far as the quantum of proof.
I think in a scientific causal toxic case, causal connection like this one, that's the way SV would work. But my position is also that this case doesn't need to be decided up there at the red box, because I think there's not legally sufficient evidence of the causal link down here at the green box. And if I as a defendant negated, if I came forward and said I can show you that there's not legally sufficient evidence of the link.
So you're saying they're not even on the chart?
Right. And my position is they had to get by the green box because they had the burden of proof on that under the case management order.
But all this assumes that we're going to say that brain cancer is the type of disease that the discovery rule applies until you know that it's caused by exposure in the workplace. Is that correct?
All this assumes that you would apply the Altai two-part test to this type of claim and ask whether or not the wrongful exposure is both inherently undiscoverable and objectively verifiable.
What about the injury itself? If we were to conclude that the injury itself was not inherently undiscoverable, does any of this apply?
Of course, under Childs, in the context of an occupational disease, you'd have to show both the injury and the causal link to the work. We think the two-part test would apply to both of those things under Childs. But now, if you don't treat it as an occupational disease case, then maybe you could go back to our first argument that we made in our brief on the merits, and you know, we felt after Childs it was pretty tough to continue to try to make that argument, that you only had to know about the injury and not the causal link. But we felt like our third argument, which is now the argument in our reply brief, was a strong argument in light of Childs, because it seems that if the statute of limitations begins to run under the discovery rule upon the plaintiff's knowledge of both the fact of injury and the causal link, then the two-part test should apply to both of those things before you
decide. Do you read Childs as overruling Marino or Ingersoll Rand?
No, I don't think Childs overrules it, but Childs is, I would say, limited to occupational disease cases.
Let me ask you, is it helpful to the analysis at all to think of, and particularly in this case, where cancer, as far as you know, appears naturally, but it can also be, I suppose, caused by external agents.
Mm-hmm.
Does it help the analysis in
considering that the word injury is a term of art, meaning it subsumes, it incorporates within this very meaning that what was happening was the result of wrongful conduct.
That's right.
So you have the causal link issue in a latent disease case simply is another way of saying this is an injury as opposed to something occurring naturally. So
that's correct.
In child silicosis, we already knew that it was only the result of an external agent that caused it. So we accept without any analysis that silicosis is an injury. Here the argument is brain cancer. There's nothing about brain cancer, even knowing you have it, that gives you any indication that it's an injury.
Mm-hmm.
It is only after determining it is resulting from an external agent do you come to a conclusion that it's an injury.
That's right.
So in this case, you don't have knowledge. This is your typical discovery rule issue, because you don't know you have an injury merely because you suffer from brain cancer. Something else has to come to your knowledge. You realize, whoops, this may be an injury. And in the workplace context, the argument would be, well, I've come to realize that the external agent is work-related. And so now it becomes an injury.
That's right.
And what's missing here is we have no determination that this is, in fact, an injury that has occurred. So we have no mechanism for discovery rule application here.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Doesn't that, though, make it inherently undiscoverable?
Sure it does. And I'm not arguing it's inherently undiscoverable, except under their arguments that, you know, they discovered from the newspaper.
But it goes to
that.
The objective.
My argument is it's not objectively verifiable.
Verifiability.
What would you put forth as being the necessary quantum of proof in order to establish?
All right, Your Honor. But for the case management order, and if I was not able to rely on them having the burden of proof, the defendant could come forward and show that there is no scientific expert consensus that brain cancer is caused by exposure to low-level radiation. See, the defendant in this case could have done it that way. We could have come in and negated the red box. Okay?
So you're saying that if a defendant negates the red box,
that he's negated objective verifiability. And if he negates objective verifiability, then he's negated the discovery rule. And if he negates the discovery rule, I win. And that's where I am. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Thomas.
May it please the court, Mr. John Barnes will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. The Court of Appeals correctly reversed and remanded this case because Rome Poloff failed to meet its burden under summary judgment. For everything else that's going on in this case, it is still a summary judgment file. Regarding the discovery
issue... You say it shifted.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
You say it shifted.
Yes.
The
burden shifted. When we agreed to the case management order, at that time, the Steeles agreed to bring forward this evidence that was outlined. They brought that evidence forward in the affidavit of Dr. Tietelbaum.
So your position is, yes, you had the burden, yes, the court could put it on you, but yes, you discharged it.
No, I don't agree that we had the burden. We simply had an agreement to bring forward a specific category of evidence, which we did in the affidavit.
All right, and if you didn't, then what?
If we didn't, then we'd be in violation of an agreed management order, and some sanctions would probably be appropriate.
But you wouldn't lose this.
Well, we wouldn't lose
this. This was a burden of production, not of persuasion.
Correct. And regarding the discovery rule, in a case such as this, the causation is inherently intertwined in the objectively verifiable aspect. We have pled that it was an injury that was unknown.
What if the cancer had occurred back in the 1950s and it was not fatal? And scientific evidence scientific knowledge didn't catch up with all of this until the 90s. Would you say that limitations is told from the 50s to the 90s until science can establish the causal link between the cancer and the occupational exposure?
I was not told for 40 years.
How long would you tell?
But at that time, there was the radium dial workers' knowledge was already there concerning some cancer. I would tell, as this court has already identified, that once the worker who has not been lackluster in determining whether there is an injury discovers that the injury was caused in the workplace.
Well, that's my hypothetical. Let's assume, just assume with me, that there was no scientific evidence of any kind back in the 50s that cancer was caused by a particular occupational exposure. But 40 years later, there was that scientific evidence. Would you toll limitations in those kinds of cases until the scientific community could look back and say, oh, these cancers we now know were caused by occupational exposures?
I have a problem there, Your Honor, and I'm not quite sure. Where did this plaintiff from the 50s determine that the injury was caused by the workplace? If the plaintiff is still in the workplace and today a doctor says your cancer is caused by X chemical, then yes, I would toll until that discovery period, because the plaintiff has not done anything wrong. The plaintiff has gone to work, has been exposed, has been injured by the exposure.
Well, in my hypothetical, the plaintiff learns when, at the same time as the studies come out, they're published on the news, and the plaintiff learns simultaneously with the scientific establishment that these types of cancers that occurred in the 50s that he had were caused by occupational exposure. Now, do you toll limitations there or not?
Yes, I would.
And why?
Because, again, the plaintiff has done nothing wrong. And to hold the plaintiff to a standard that would not allow the plaintiff to file at that time would require workers such as Jeffrey Steele and his wife Kenda to have the scientific acumen, in his case, of oncology.
So you basically say we toll limitations until the scientific community can catch up and tell us what the causation is.
Yes, I would. And I would again, because based on these facts, the Steeles had done nothing wrong. As Dr. Tietelbaum noted in his affidavit, Jeffrey Steele was a regular attender at work. And his regular appearance at work is indeed what caused him to have such massive exposure. The causation in this case follows a long line of cases handled by this court in the past few years with Robinson. I think that it is important to view the affidavits in comparison. Dr. Tietelbaum's affidavit established several things. One, that there were specific environmental hazards encountered by Jeffrey Steele. He identified the hazards encountered by Mr. Steele at work. Mr. Steele himself talked about how his work situation, he was often almost immersed in radioactive chemicals. Now, he has listed specific authorities for his conclusion on his affidavit. So we have training, we have experience, we have knowledge of an expert witness. So the only thing that would be left would be methodology. And the methodology followed by Dr. Tietelbaum is the methodology followed by occupational toxicologists, which he is by profession. He is not someone who was hired to write a report for a lawsuit. This is what Dr. Tietelbaum does. The problem is...
May I ask the question? There's some argument that your doctor's affidavit doesn't exclude any other source for the onset of the brain tumor, and that he only focuses on attempting to make a link between the workplace and Mr. Steele's disease. Is that part of your burden, if you accept the burden of production that link two things?
Under summary judgment, our burden is to raise a material fact issue to avoid summary judgment.
Well, would that then include showing that other sources are excluded vis-a-vis Mr. Steele then?
Your Honor, one of the most difficult things in the law is to prove a negative. And while it is possible that that might be the case, if we look then at Stanley Peer's affidavit, the PhD expert hired by Rose Polon as its expert witness, that affidavit makes a global conclusory statement about, well, it could have been cigarettes, it could have been any number of things.
Well, I'm not trying to say that what their expert said does or doesn't controvert what your expert said, but under the posture of this case and what happened, in your agreement that you would produce, how much do you have to produce to raise a fact question, negating other sources in this particular case to show causation?
That's the problem with all of these cases with the scientific
causation. Well, but we don't have that problem in silicosis or asbestosis anymore because other sources, when you have workplace exposure, are excluded.
Yes.
And the scientific community agrees on that. But do we have in the methodology of a scientific community agreeing that because these facts occur, there's no other source for this brain tumor?
It goes to the level of the burden of proof as well. Looking at this chart, if we have to go to a causal link conclusively proven to get beyond summary judgment,
well, then we might as well stop the case there and just prove up damages.
Well, because how would we do that if we can't? I mean, conclusively proving something sounds more like the criminal burden of beyond a reasonable doubt. And what doctor must do here is establish that there is a genuine material fact issue. Is it possible that Jeffrey Steele's exposure to the radioactive material at Rome Colon was the cause of his brain tumor? And once that is done, then it should move forward. The case should move forward.
Well, would your expert have given the same affidavit within the two-year limitations period?
I'm sorry?
Would your expert have given the same affidavit within the two-year limitations period? In other words, what in the record is there about the advancements of science and knowledge that happened between the running of limitations and the time that the lawsuit was filed?
You're talking if the discovery rule did not apply to you.
No, I'm talking about whether it applies. You're saying that, well, I'm entitled to wait until the scientific evidence catches up so I can realize what caused my injury. What evidence is there that had this plaintiff been diligent and gone to the books or consulted your own expert, that he would have been told your brain cancer is probably caused by your occupational injury or exposure, and that he would have been told this within the limitations period?
I don't believe there is anything in the record, Your Honor. All that is in the record is that we know that Jeffrey Steele was diagnosed by a medical doctor with having a brain tumor.
Well, what makes his injury inherently undiscoverable?
Because he went to a doctor, and his doctor did not tell him at that time.
But is there evidence that no doctor could have told him at that time that it was related to his occupation?
There is nothing in the record that indicates that, Your Honor.
Well, let me ask you about that then. In your brief, you say that your doctor's affidavit should be upheld because it was common knowledge that working in places where there's radioactivity that causes cancer. If it was common knowledge, is it also common knowledge to Mr. Steele that he should have made a contact between the diagnosis in October of 89 and his workplace since he knew that he was working with radioactive material?
That is always open to question, Your Honor, about what intellectual level any given plaintiff may possess.
Well, common knowledge doesn't basically involve intellect. It involves what people know generally, doesn't it?
It does indeed involve what people generally know. And perhaps I misspoke by saying that perhaps it would be better said that the hazards of radioactivity may be generally known. But what is not commonly known is the specific link to occupational workers, which again, not in the record, but historically looking back at all the instances, the radium dial workers and the health problems they had. So it becomes a fact issue, though, whether Jeffrey Steele should have known of the occupational nature of his injury.
But before we get to that question, we have to ask, should people generally know, is it generally accepted that this type of work involves a risk of brain cancer? Just like working around silicon dust involves a risk of silicosis and working around asbestos involves a risk of asbestosis. If that risk is not the same high level, doesn't that fail to meet the objective verifiability problem?
Well, we don't No, it doesn't. It doesn't because, again, it's it is situation specific when the hazard is not as clearly known as it is with asbestosis and silicosis. And that's why in a fact-intensive situation, such as the Rhone-Poland matter, it is a question of fact that should be decided by the jury, whether Jeffrey Steele's conduct was reasonable.
Well, that is a question of fact that a fact finder would have to decide. But whether causation is objectively verifiable is not a question of fact, except that it must be informed by the facts. Is that true or not?
Well, it must be objectively verifiable in some manner, but in this case it would have to be by a scientist, a doctor, or someone with special knowledge. So,
well, so then your common knowledge comments in your brief have to do with the scientific environment and not the worker environment knowledge.
That would be a fair interpretation, Your Honor, because it, again, this is such a fact-intensive situation.
Well, and when I read the record, there seems to be a clear gap on both sides of what happened, if anything, from October of 89 to September of 90 by Mr. Steele. Now, and you also stated in your brief that the diligence is when you found out in 1990 from reading the Brazosport News that you diligently filed your suit. I raise a question. The diligence in the discovery rule is from the time the injury occurred until you knew or should have known, rather when you filed your suit. Would you agree with that?
Well, yes. And,
and so the diligence period in this case is from 89 to 90.
It's from 89 until Kenda Steele became aware.
That's October of 89 to September of 90 when Mrs. Steele read the paper.
And she filed suit within 2 years, technically slightly over because the deadline fell on the
week. Do you agree with my statement that the diligence that the court must look at is what happened between the time you discover you have an injury and the time that you discover where it comes from?
What I'm referring to is
the factual situation in the Child and Humble cases where one point of learning of a disease took all kinds of efforts to see doctors.
Yes.
But every time he went, they said something different other than this is a latent occupational disease of silicosis. In the other case, the plaintiff did absolutely nothing for a long period of time. And this record doesn't show one way or the other what, if anything, was done by Mr. Steele.
One distinction in this case, though, from the Hossecker and Martinez fact pattern is that in this case, there was a much shorter time frame.
Well, I understand, but that's a crucial time frame, wouldn't you agree?
It is.
If you can't get to September 1990, even if the discovery rule applies, you're too late.
Well, the brain tumor was diagnosed.
Yes, I understand.
But the causation...
No, I understand, but what, hypothetically, should Mr. and Mrs. Steele do when they find out they have a brain tumor and he knows he's working in a workplace that has radioactive material?
When he discovers that the radioactive materials are perhaps the cause, or likely the cause, or profess to be the cause of the injury, now it goes from merely an illness of a tumor to an injury caused by some specific act, then at that moment the statute would begin to toll. The cause of action would accrue at that moment.
Mr. Barnes, in response to Justice Heck's question, you kept saying that the question of the objective verifiability is fact intensive. And that is one element of our discovery, of what we apply to determine if the discovery rule does apply in a particular case.
Yes.
Isn't the question of whether the discovery rule applies a question of law for the court?
It is, but at the same time, Your Honor, it involves some evidence of the causation.
And so while it's, quote, fact-intensive and the court must look at the facts, the court must make a determination as a matter of law whether the two prongs of the discovery rule test, in fact, have been met.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so that does present a question of law for the court.
Yes. The discovery rule of the statute presents a question of law for the court. But again, in a circumstance such as this, the objective verifiability hinges on the input from some expert in the field. And that's what Dr. Teelbaum's affidavit also did, raised a question, at least for the court, because the court must make that determination, whether it is possible that this injury was caused by radiation in the workplace.
But we've said it can't just be possible. It has to be a consensus, virtual consensus, actually. Because if it's a question of he said, he said, he said, she said, then that's not objectively verifiable. That's just one, that's just a swearing match.
Well, Your Honor, that's right. And the swearing match aspect of this, this is a case I think that presents, as Justice Gonzalez noted, that sometimes it's better for the court to have its own disinterested expert. Justice Breyer, in his concurrence in General Electric case, said the same thing. And the New England Journal of Medicine had filed an amicus brief in General Electric asking the court to appoint its own disinterested counsel. And this is the kind of file that would be, I think, ideally suited to this court establishing such a rule, much as courts do now with mediation or other alternative dispute resolution. The parties could be charged with determining between themselves the technology and then have a special report. If they cannot do that, the court could appoint a special master, as already done in other circumstances. This master could prepare a factual report on the scientific background. And of course, the trial court would have the ultimate ruling, but it would be guided by an expert in the field that has no interest in the outcome. And I think when the courts are freed from that, particularly, for example, I think the Brazoria court is a good example of why this would be an effective plan. Brazoria's court has, the district court hears divorce, it hears criminal, it hears civil, it hears probate sometimes, so it has a wide variety. If that court could rely on a disinterested expert witness report when these sorts of issues are presented, I think that would promote not only the efficiency of the court system, but the effectiveness. The trial court would be free from the courtroom battles which we have all seen on these discovery issues, dealing with whether an expert is qualified, and whether the expert has followed an accepted plan of action.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Let me just be clear about one thing. If you read the record in the trial court in this case, it's very clear that the parties and the trial court treated these case management orders as if they shifted the burden of proof to the plaintiff to prove causation. So I would say, in answer to what Chief Justice Phillips said, is the order on its face doesn't say burden of production versus burden of persuasion. It does say that the plaintiff has to come forward with the opinion of a medical doctor based on reasonable degree of medical probability, which is, of course, the no evidence language out of Hafner. Okay? And it does say that he has to show that it's a substantial contributing cause and give the basis of its opinion. It doesn't say whether it's talking about the burden of persuasion or the burden of production. But the parties, if you read Rome Blanc's motion for summary judgment and their response, and don't forget that the court granted summary judgment on the Gregory Steel claims solely on the basis of causation. And there's not an affidavit from our side that says, let me come in and conclusively show you there's no causation. So the trial court obviously read his order as putting the burden of proof on the plaintiff.
But he probably couldn't do that over their objection.
But they didn't object, Your Honor. If these were two agreed case management orders, they signed them.
But that doesn't mean that you agreed to produce something in discovery that you agreed that you assume a summary judgment for.
Well, that's what I'm getting to, Your Honor, is what is the proper interpretation of the order? And my argument to the court is that the proper interpretation of the order, take the face of the order, read it in the context of the record below, and I think you'll come to the conclusion that the parties in the court understood this to shift the burden of persuasion on the summary judgment to the plaintiff. See, this plaintiff sued 90 defendants, and the judge was trying to deal with the fact that he'd sued 90 defendants. And you couldn't, you know, it was anybody that ever had anything to do with this plan. And to ferret this out, the judge said in his agreed order again that they agreed to, and ordered them to come forward with this proof of causation. And then Rome Blanc filed his motion for summary judgment and says, okay, you told him to come forward with proof of causation. Dr. Tittlebaum's affidavit is no good under Dobear Robinson. It's legally insufficient evidence.
He filed a motion to strike that affidavit. What happened to that motion?
Which is, the motion was not ruled on. There's not a ruling on that motion.
In your summary judgment reply, did you anywhere object to the use of the affidavit independently of your motion to strike?
In the first motion for summary judgment, which we explained in our reply brief as a live motion, the trial judge granted both of our motions. He reserved a ruling on the first one, granted our plural motions. We urged that Tittlebaum's opinion was no good, legally insufficient evidence under Havner and Dobear.
Well, but your first motion, they just put a letter in. And then they have an affidavit by the time your second motion was on file?
They did, Your Honor, but the same
thing. So doesn't that make things kind of different between the two motions?
Well, but the second motion re-urged the grounds of the first motion. So the second motion, we cited that in our reply brief, the second motion would be re-urging the complaint about Dobear and Robinson. And if I could just touch on that briefly, the plaintiff talks about GE versus Joyner. I hope you all read GE versus Joyner. I know you have because it's cited extensively in the Gamble case. If you look at Tittlebaum's opinion in this case and compare it to what the U.S. Supreme Court wrote about Dr. Tittlebaum's opinion in that case, it suffers from precisely the same defects, precisely the same. There, Dr. Tittlebaum said that the plaintiff's workplace exposure to PCBs caused his lung cancer. Here, he says the plaintiff's workplace exposure to radiation caused his brain cancer. But in, the Supreme Court pointed out he leapt to the conclusion without eliminating other factors. He relied on animal studies without explaining how you could extrapolate to animal studies. He relied on irrelevant studies. He relied on studies that reached the opposite conclusion. All of these are exactly what's wrong with his opinion in our case.
And in Joyner, the Supreme Court was determining what the appropriate standard of review was.
That's true.
Using a trial court decision under 702 to exclude evidence.
That's true.
The determination was made that
he did
abuse his
discretion.
Not use his discretion excluding the evidence. How procedurally does that tie in with where we are in terms of this unusual posture with scheduling order and summary judgment motion.
You're absolutely right, Judge Hankinson, but of course in Havner, the court wrote that the Robinson factors on admissibility also go to no evidence. And procedurally, how it ties in is that we complained in our motion for summary judgment that the affidavit was no evidence. And
but
the only
you don't have the benefit of Part I when you filed your motion in this case.
I don't have the benefit of a new summary judgment.
That's what I mean.
No, I understand that.
Seems to me that your argument is, well, we ought to have the benefit of it. This is a no evidence case, and therefore we win.
Well, that's exactly right.
And you win because of the case management
order. That's right. Two case management orders. That's right, Your Honor. That's
so your view is that the plaintiff had to prove, and in the context of a summary judgment, conclusively, that causation was there. And they couldn't do it, so they lose.
Well, he had to come forward with at least legally sufficient evidence to raise a fact issue on causation. That's what this order requires him to do, to come forward with a medical opinion based on reasonable probability and show how it's supported. And that's what they didn't do. That's why we think we should prevail.
Yeah, I have a question. This goes back to what I was asking early on. I'm not really interested in the trial court reversing the burden of proof and that sort of thing. But the question is, how does one who wants to take the benefit of the discovery rule exception to the running statute of limitations establish the prong of objectively verifiable? Do we have any sufficient evidence? Do we have disputed evidence? Do we have conclusive? It seems to me you argue that to get objectively verifiable, the plaintiff must conclusively establish a causal link. But assuming you had the burden of proof, you take the position that we could establish, we can conclusively prove non-causal link, but we're not on the merits. We're simply talking about, can I get past the standard summary and a statute of limitations defense,
right?
Not on the merits, but limitations defense. What level does there need to be anything further on objectively verifiable than in a latent occupational disease case where there's a question of whether or not this injury was caused by occupation? Does it take anything more than simply someone who's versed in expertise in that science to come forward and say there is a link? Does it take anything more to get to the second prong of that this is an objectively verifiable injury?
Oh, yes, Your Honor. I think it takes a lot more. I mean, if you're going to attempt to establish, and for summary judgment purposes as a defendant, forget the shifting of the burden of proof, to negate the discovery rule, then you would have to demonstrate that it meant no objective verifiability, negate objective verifiability, as that standard is set forth in SB.
But I'm talking about the plaintiff. The plaintiff has to show the applicability, ultimately, of the discovery rule.
Right. Now, but on summary judgment, before the new summary judgment rule...
No, I'm not talking about anything the defendant has to do.
Okay.
If the defendant's going to win, the defendant's going to have to conclusively prove that isn't the case.
Right.
I'm going the other way.
Okay.
What does it take for the plaintiff to get over the threshold that my injury was objectively verifiable in a case where it is contested whether there is a causal link?
At trial?
The
reason I'm asking, Your Honor, is I think on summary judgment, it wouldn't be the defendant's burden. Under the old summary judgment rule, the plaintiff's burden, because the defendant would have...
Okay, then what does it take to raise a fact issue on that issue?
To raise a fact issue, you would at least have to have legally sufficient evidence of the causal link, because otherwise there couldn't be a dispute for the jury to decide. You couldn't even get up to a dispute between experts on the swearing match, which under SC isn't even enough. You have to get up to scientific expert consensus. So I think if the defendant was trying to demonstrate on summary judgment that it was conclusively established that it's not objectively verifiable, I would have had to come in with an affidavit and say, look, there's no scientific expert consensus that brain cancer can be caused by radiation. None. These people are never going to meet us, but I can negate that. And the reason that I think I didn't have to do that here is because I stand on the shifting burden of proof, and I say he was supposed to prove legally sufficient evidence of a causal link, which is a fundamental building block. If you don't have legally sufficient evidence, you can't possibly get up to expert scientific consensus. And if his evidence was legally insufficient under this court's decisions in Catherine and Robinson, and accordingly, on that basis alone, objective verifiability is negated.
And you're saying that Dr. Tietelbaum doesn't get them on the board at all?
Dr. Tietelbaum cannot possibly get to the green legally sufficient evidence of causal link under this court's decisions in Hatton.
That point aside,
right.
Leaving that point aside, I want you to help make sense for me an incongruity in your position.
Okay.
And that is, it seems as though the outcome of your position would be that if you can prove your claim through, say, scientific expert consensus on a causal link, then you can benefit from the discovery rule and you don't have to file your claim right away. If, however, you cannot prove your claim, then you don't get the benefit of the discovery rule and you do have to file your lawsuit right away. If you cannot prove your claim because at this particular time you don't have a consensus of scientific evidence,
right.
If you cannot prove your claim,
right.
Then by golly, you need to go ahead and file your lawsuit now because limitations is running.
Well,
that doesn't make sense.
Well, except that if I'm reading SB correctly, if you have to sue timely and you don't get the benefit of the discovery rule, then you get to go to the jury on lesser levels of proof. The swearing match between experts. Okay? I mean, you're never going to get to the jury at all as a plaintiff if you can't prove legally sufficient evidence, right? But under SB, you could get to the jury on the swearing match. You don't have to get up to a higher level of proof of the scientific expert consensus if you sue quicker. But if you want the benefit of the discovery rule, then by gosh, you better have very strong proof and you better be able to meet the scientific expert consensus. That's the way I read SB.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court will take another brief recess.